I'm Shelley Weldon. I'm an assistant professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I'm here today with Dave Spence, who is the Baker Botts Chair in Law at the University of Texas School of Law. And we're going to talk about his forthcoming paper, The New Politics of Energy Market Entry, that's coming out in the Notre Dame Law Review later this year. So, Dave, thanks very much for being here with me.
You're welcome.
So I thought I would just start by asking you a few broad questions about the piece and what you found in it. So this paper is about non-governmental organization opposition to the siting of energy infrastructure, including both fossil fuel and clean energy infrastructure. So what motivated you to want to study this issue?
Well, good question. So I think there were two basic sets of motivations. One was a perception on my part that siting conflicts were becoming more frequently intense and contentious over time. I think there are good reasons for that and bad reasons for that phenomenon. People, among the good reasons are sort of increasing public concern over particularly fossil fuel infrastructure and locking in carbon for the future. And so that worry about climate change and about the limited window of opportunity to address it motivates some of that intensity. But I also thought there were other sort of less defensible reasons for that sort of increasing intensity and contentiousness. And those were really related to the sort of combination of increasing political polarization, the effects of sort of the digital world, the fact that we get our news and process our news online, and human biases, sort of those normal human biases that we all sort of know about from the behavioral psychology. So the combination of, so that perception led me to worry about the problems associated with siting, worry that there were more political barriers to siting. And that's a worry because in a green transition, we're going to need to build a lot of stuff. We're going to need to build a lot more utility scale wind and solar, and we're going to need to build a lot of transmission lines to link those things together. Almost every analysis, not almost, every analysis of how we might green the electricity sector involves building a whole lot of new infrastructure. And so if that is more difficult to do politically, that's a problem. And the other aspect of my worry is that as these siting conflicts have become more contentious, the creative use of legal leverage, I think, is running the risk of creating precedents in the opposition to fossil fuel infrastructure that could come back to bite us when we try to cite clean energy infrastructure, particularly transmission. And I'm referring here to increasingly aggressive arguments about eminent domain, and also more aggressive use of the 401 certification process under the Clean Water Act to stop natural gas pipelines.
Mm-hmm. So jumping into this topic of how NGOs oppose energy infrastructure is a complicated one empirically. And I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about how you went about studying the issue, and just broadly, what did you find about how NGOs are opposing clean energy infrastructure? Well, all energy infrastructure, I guess.
So the in terms of how we approach the task, and I say we because I had the help of a small army of research assistants over maybe about an 18-month period here. We started by gathering information about NGOs whose missions include opposing energy infrastructure. We limited ourselves to activities in the 21st century, so the study period runs through 2017. And we simply tried to identify who those NGOs are, and this includes everything from very local NGOs to international NGOs. We ended up grouping all the NGOs into either of two categories, local or national. National includes the international. Local includes all the sort of subnational NGOs. We identified them through searches online and searches of Facebook, and then ultimately searches of legal databases on Lexis. And for each NGO, we gathered information about them, certain basic identifying information, but also information about the way they opposed new energy infrastructure. And we grouped those into two categories. We looked at the tactics they chose to pursue as a mode of opposition. And we looked at the issue arguments they made to oppose the projects that they opposed. In the former category, we divided the tactics into four categories: formal intervention in legal proceedings as a party, protests like picketing and marching and that sort of thing, the kind of things we saw in opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline, boycotts or economic pressure, and a larger category we called political mobilization. This really was a way of capturing efforts on the part of NGOs to mobilize the general public to officially participate in opposing a project. So this would include trying to get the public to write letters to a regulator or to a legislature. On the issue side, we also divided their activities into four categories, two of which focused on risk. So if their arguments against the project were about health risks posed by the project, we had a health risk category. We also had a non-health environmental risk category. So they may have emphasized damage to the environment or risks to the environment. And then we had an economic category. Some NGOs argue that the project will do economic harm either to the average person's pocketbook or to property values and that sort of thing. And the fourth category was about environmental justice. So if they raised environmental justice or environmental sort of fairness, socioeconomic fairness arguments, that it's important to emphasize that NGOs, we found, use more than one tactic and often raise more than one issue. So these are not, but we took all that information and we just sort of looked at it and organized it and tried to extract from it the major findings, the major conclusions. Since you asked what those were, I'll sort of summarize really quickly the ones we focused on in this paper. The first thing, and I say none of these are particularly surprising, but they're interesting nevertheless. The first one was that by far the most common approach to opposition was for NGOs to engage in political mobilization around risk, health or environmental risks. This was a far more commonly used tactic than formal legal intervention or protest or economic boycotts. Some of those other tactics get more press attention, but the just generalized mobilization, getting the public to participate in the process, was by far the most common approach that NGOs used. And then the second sort of major finding was that we saw evidence, and this was a little bit more surprising to me, we saw quite a bit of evidence of coordination between NGOs in a vertical sense. So national NGOs coordinating with local NGOs. I wasn't necessarily expecting to find that. We hypothesized in this paper that we ought to see more differences between national and local NGOs, and we did find some of those, but there was quite a bit of what seemed to be coordination. It's very difficult to document this because sometimes it's, I don't want to say hidden, but it's not evident that it's happening, but we infer it from behavior in that, particularly in opposition to fossil fuel projects, we saw quite a bit of sort of complementary and similar tactics and issue arguments there. So we know that the Sierra Club, for example, coordinates sometimes with its local chapters, and that there are NRDC and other groups offer sort of how-to kits for local opposition to, say, fracking. So we know that it happens, but we found quite a bit of similarity in the way they pursued some of this stuff, particularly within the fossil fuel category. Mm-hmm. I should say that in opposition to clean energy infrastructure, we found some differences, in particular with respect to health risk arguments that the NGOs made. Local NGOs were much more likely to engage in opposition based on claims about health risk that we characterize as hyperbolic because they aren't supported by the sort of consensus, the scientific consensus. So for example, claims about wind turbine syndrome or wind turbines causing health effects or transmission lines causing health effects or smart meters causing health effects. These are all claims that are fairly frequently made by local NGOs, but are not really supported by the bulk of the scientific literature, and they are not likely to be made by national NGOs.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that brings me to a question. I think the politics of this opposition to energy infrastructure are complicated because there are so many different types of projects being pursued. And I know you tried to look at the role of political ideology and how it fit into these patterns. So what did you find there?
So in the second part of the paper, we try to look at the very question you asked, and we do so, and I think, in a kind of a blunt way. Basically, we looked at the incidence of opposition, how many NGOs formed to oppose particular projects, and we tried to connect that to the intensity of development of that particular type of project in a state and the sort of dominant political ideology in the state. There are measures of the latter, sort of median level of liberalism or conservatism in a state, and we had information about the intensity of development, the number of projects in each state. And so we looked at that data to see if we could find anything, and that the findings are, I think we found sort of weak correlations between opposition and left-leaning ideology. So for example, even though California is one of the strongest renewable state, we found more opposition to utility scale solar farms in California than anywhere else. Part of that is attributable to the fact that there is more development in California than anywhere else. But even that aside, we found those kinds of correlations, I would say, weakly in many different project categories. So the place we found it most strongly was in opposition to LNG terminals, liquefied natural gas terminals. And the projects in Maryland and Oregon, which were by far the two most liberal states in which projects were proposed, attracted enormous amounts of opposition, far more than you found in the Gulf Coast states. That's probably not too surprising because those states are used to oil and gas infrastructure. The other problem with this, of trying to do this, is that there's a censored sample problem. Project sponsors know, or at least can make educated guesses about where intense opposition is likely to arise, and probably don't propose projects in those places in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So one of the findings that I found most interesting was the ways in which local and national groups sometimes diverge in their support. So I'm thinking in particular, you gave the example in the paper of a local Sierra Club chapter that opposed a solar project when the national club didn't. And to my mind, this brought up the sort of perennial debate that's happened in the environmental law scholarship about what's the right level of government at which to regulate various things. So did your sense of the ways in which national and local NGOs were bringing up different arguments shed any light for you on the question of the right level of government at which to site energy infrastructure?
Yeah, I have thoughts about those issues. So the other example that we mentioned in the paper is the Northern Pass transmission line, which would bring hydroelectric power into New England.
Right.
And there was a split between National Sierra Club, or a kind of a split between National Sierra Club and local Sierra Club on that issue as well. There's sort of a fundamental incentives divergence here between national groups and local groups. Local groups, it's perfectly rational to oppose new infrastructure if it's going to impose even marginal costs on your neighborhood if you're not getting any of the benefit from it. And so local groups have this incentive to not only say no, but to try and broaden their basis of opposition by getting new members added. And that may be one reason why they're more prone to hyperbolic claims about risk. But it's logical. It's rational for them to do that. Whereas the national groups are repeat players in all of these conflicts. They also have a broader agenda. So National Sierra Club presumably has an interest, an intense interest in having clean energy infrastructure be built. And they have to maintain sort of credibility there. They don't want to be making claims that will diminish their credibility. And so it's perfectly understandable why we would see these sort of divergences between national and local groups on occasion. I think since we are going to have to build a lot of new clean energy infrastructure, one of the things I say in the paper is that I think national environmental groups are going to have to get more comfortable with affirmatively championing particular projects, even over the opposition of local groups. I think that is culturally for the organizations a really hard thing to do. Most of them were created in response to opposition to infrastructure. That's how environmental groups typically arise. And it's sort of in the DNA to sort of champion local opponents on whom something is being imposed. But there's no way around the fact that any transition to a green electricity sector is going to involve forcing infrastructure on people that don't want it. Mm-hmm. And so I think having national environmental groups champion these kinds of projects before public utility commissions and other agencies is going to have to be an element of building out the new green grid if we're going to do it quickly enough. That was one of the major conclusions we reached. As to your second question about where should these decisions be made, I think there are elements of the existing regulatory system that where we have a mismatch between the nature of the problem and the jurisdiction that controls it. And I'm thinking primarily of transmission lines here. So we don't have a national siting regime for transmission the way we do for natural gas pipelines. That's an artifact of the history of both the Natural Gas Act and the Federal Power Act. Back when the Natural Gas Act was passed, production of natural gas happened far from customers. And so we thought we needed a national siting regime to allow siting across state lines. Power plants back in the 1930s were built right close to the customers. Now we have all this wind and solar that we'd like to build in the windy central plains and the sunny desert southwest that is far from customers. And we need the ability to build the transmission across state lines to do that. And since states are responsible for siting transmission, that jurisdictional mismatch is acting as an impediment to the building out of the green grid. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Dave, I want to thank you very much for joining me today to talk about the new politics of energy market entry.
My pleasure.